Hello, friends, and welcome to Brothers in Song. How have you been, Joe?
I've been doing pretty well, Danny. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm hanging in there. We're
Yeah.
approaching the, I mean, I suppose it's not the darkest days of the year in terms of light, but it sure is the darkest days of the year in terms of like quality
stuff
of
going
life,
out.
If I think. Because it, you know, January, February, not
well,
the most fun time
I
of year
I came out
for me.
And met you for a drink during the week between Christmas and New Year's. Maybe we should just save that outing for now. But I guess there's no reason why we couldn't do it next week anyway, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you got to do something to break things up this time of year when it's just, you know, cold and gray all the time in our neck of the woods.
Absolutely.
But be that as it may.
Well, I you know what, Dan? I got something to break up the monotony of a cold winter evening in Connecticut.
Yeah, go for it.
How about you listen to your favorite podcast, Brothers in Song? Because we have a delightful one planned for you guys tonight.
There you go.
So there we left go. It a
smooth
little
transition.
Bit, yeah, so we left it a little bit open-ended at our last episode, and it was one to leave you in suspense, but two for us and specifically me to get my act together. But I came up with this idea. I thought it'd be a bit fun. So we're gonna talk about three opera trios today, and the reason why I chose trios is because duets are a little basic, and trios are incredibly complicated for all the reasons you would think. And before we get into it, you know, when I think of things that go together into threes, I think BLT, like a classic thing.
Yeah, yeah.
An old fashioned only has three ingredients.
True.
You know, my kids would say the best trio ever is Harry, Ron, and Hermione. So what are some of your favorite trios, musical or otherwise? I'd love to hear some.
Well, first I have to say, and I'm kind of borrowing a phrase from you, just like kids, you know, when you get more than one, more than two, you know, three kids or three singers is not three times as hard as one. It's like 100 times as hard as one.
Absolutely.
Because you're right, the trios that you presented us are definitely have a lot of complexity in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as trios that come to my mind, the very first one I thought of was A Heart Full of Love from Les Mis. And I listened to that musical a ton in high school, believe it or not. It was one of my favorite things.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there is an operatic quality to it, even though
Absolutely.
It's not technically opera.
Yeah.
And that song gets overshadowed by the other big numbers in that show, but it's got great harmonies, especially at the end, the last chord that those three singers sing together right at the end of the song is just mm-hmm. pure gold. This song occurs toward the end of the first act and kind of sets up the Marius Cosette Eponine dynamic for the rest of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a more kind of beautiful and melodic song that contrasts the other songs in that show and in the first act. So I really like that one. Another one I thought of immediately, I don't know why, but it is one I like just for the pure schmaltz factor. And that's All for Love by Bryan Adams, Sting, and Rod Stewart. And they did that. They did that. Do you know that song?
Yes. Yes, of course I know that one.
So they did that song for the Three Musketeers movie from 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to the voices in that song, They've got more sandpaper than a Home Depot. And
in 1993, for certain, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're not a music nut with a good ear, you might not even be able to tell those three guys apart. But it's such a, like, cheesy power ballad, but, man, is it fun to sing along to, for sure. And then the last one I got is, and this might be a surprise to some, but honestly, it's really tough to resist this song, and that's the song Bang Bang by Jessie J, Ariana Grande, and Nicki Minaj.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm not going to try and justify liking that song with a bunch of, you know, academic sounding aesthetic arguments. All I can really say is that it's just pure candy, ice cream, junk food, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And you need that in your life for every once in a while. So those were my three, and I just kind of went with my first instincts, the first three that popped into my head.
That is quite an eclectic collection that you put together, buddy.
What can I tell you? The free association, that's what happens.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the fun of those sorts of questions. So I like all those selections, and I know them all. The Sting, Bryan Adams, and Rod Stewart one, that definitely threw me for a loop, because I haven't thought about that in years. And years and years.
Well, let me tell you something, Joe. No one has.
You don't say. No, those are three really good ones. But let's get to the topic at hand. So, you know, with this exercise, my hope was, one, as always, to expose you and our listeners to a little bit more opera. And I feel like these are three pretty fun entry points for folks. And what's really, interesting about all three is just how the composer approached dealing with having three characters sing at the same time. And, in our first example, cause we have three examples for tonight, we're going to take a look at Mozart's opera, La Notte di Figaro, which, made its premiere in 1786. And the piece, and there are a couple of trios and actually many ensemble pieces in this opera, which are always kind of fun and, you know, fun to perform, because I've done this opera, but also just fun to listen to. And it adds a little bit of a almost chaotic element to the opera, which it's supposed to be. So as we do with some of these operas, I'm going to give you, you know, a 10-second synopsis, and
love it.
Hopefully this will make sense to some of our listeners. I screen tested it with you prior to this, and you didn't know what I was talking about, but it's basically Downton Abbey if Lord Grantham was trying to get with all the servants. That's what La Notte di Figaro is about. So yeah. It's like probably one of the first examples of kind of an upstairs downstairs screwball comedy. And what we're going to talk about today is the trio that's in the second act. This is a four act opera. So it's towards the second half of the first usual half. And then they take an intermission after the second act, and it's Susanna Orvia Sortite. And it's a trio between the Count, the Countess, and Susanna, who is the, I guess, maid slash primary servant to the Contessa, or the Countess. Hijinks ensues, and Susanna is supposed to be in one place, but she's really in another, and the Count is very suspicious. And so he comes in, he's like, Susanna, come on out of the closet. I don't know why you're in there. And they continue to argue, and it's pretty fun. But the reason why I chose this one is because people throw this word around a lot with Mozart, but it truly is genius counterpoint writing, because you have the Count, who's a baritone, who's kind of, you know, as you would expect, he's kind of driving the action in the scene because he's pissed and he wants people to do what he tells them to do. and people are saying, no, we're not going to do that right now. And then you have the two soprano voices. And typically, the Countess is somebody who's, you know, a little bit, the character's a little bit older, and the person who sings it tends to be a little bit older, a little bit fuller voice. And Susanna is a little bit lighter and has usually like a very high soprano voice. And what's really creative about this is how all the voices come together, and there's almost like a passage of the melody between the three voices. It's not like with a lot of duets, it's usually either sung completely in unison or maybe in thirds, or it's more of like a call, like, I'm going to take my turn, you take your turn, and we'll come together at the end. But trios, you can't really do that. And so I love how this kind of melds all those things together and keeps the action moving. And they do that by having the melody jump from character to character, which is really fun. So, Dan, I don't think you've heard this before, but I'm curious, what were your impressions of it?
So the seemingly chaotic nature of all the overlapping vocals, you know, where the characters are almost trying to talk over for one another, is perfect for like a farcical screwball kind of scene like this. And, you know, and in watching this, it's like, you know, this could be the part of the plot of, like, I don't know, Saved by the Bell or like Perfect Strangers or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's such an amazing skill for the composer, in this case Mozart, to create something that seems like chaos, but obviously it's just very well crafted, because if it were truly chaos, it would sound like crap, and it doesn't. It sounds beautiful. You know, the way that all of that is orchestrated together is really great. And the way that the music kind of builds that tension in a comedic way. You know, are they going to find Susanna? Are they not going to find Susanna? You know, she's hiding from the big, you know, sort of villain or the heavy in the story.
Big lord of the manor, yeah.
Yeah. So the way that those vocal lines, you know, weave in and out and create that sense of chaos was just perfect for the scene. And the example that you gave me, like, the voices are great and are singing this really challenging stuff, but it doesn't sound challenging for them.
No, you know what I mean? And they're running around stage the entire time, right?
Right,
Because, like, you know, depending on the staging, like, you will have folks that are like literally like barricading the closet and making sure that the Count doesn't get to go where he's trying to go. And like, it's very much like a classic, like if you've ever taken an acting class, like the character has one objective and you need to prevent that from happening. And how are you going to do that? And you're like, by any means necessary, that's how I'm going to do it. And so a lot of the staging basically employs that philosophy, and it can get a little crazy. But, you know, back to the singing for a second, you know, one of the things that, you know, I've listened to this, you know, many, many times, but one of the passages that just sticks out to me is it's a couple of times, and with the way that it's orchestrated, it changes keys, but basically there's like this run, and it's I think it is an octave. And I think I know which, I think you know what I'm referring to. Mm-hmm. And the character just kind of floats up there.
Yeah.
And then the music stops for a beat. And then it starts up again. And it happens 3 or 4 times. And it's just gorgeous. And, like, usually you think, oh, well, like, an opera. Like, when there's a beautiful moment, everything stops. There's all this pomp and circus. But it's like, no. This beautiful thing happens. And then they just move on to the next thing. And that's just a credit to the composer and the writing. Because it's... Because, like, the first couple times I heard that, I was like, wait a minute. That's not, like, just, like, a little run. That's, like, serious singing. And then we don't, like, take a moment to embrace that. Nope. We just go on to the next thing. It's just par for the course. And that's what you got to bring to the table if you're going to do that role.
You know, for anyone who has, you know, preconceived notions about opera singing and... you know, how it's supposed to sound, you know, particularly for sopranos, that, you know, it can be like high and shrill and unpleasant. It's like these women are singing like some real, you know, money notes and just make it sound so pretty and so effortless and so easy. While, you know, like you said, while maintaining their character and moving around and you know, having a sense of timing because it's a comedy and, you know, all of that. So, so this was a pretty impressive piece and I enjoyed it.
Great. I always enjoy this one. So
yeah.
I enjoyed it as well. So let's move on. Let's go to our next one, which is from, an opera written, by Gounod's Faust. It was premiered in 1859, and it's Que Voulez-Vous? And for our little synopsis, and it, as you would expect, it's the Legend of Faust, which is a pretty well-known, you know, story in Western culture. But I guess the 10-second synopsis of the opera is, okay, so you're telling me I sell my soul, but I get to be with this wonderful woman? I'm in. That's it.
Pretty much.
For this scene, it's essentially one of the first, you talking to me scenes? Because we got a beef and let's, you want to go outside? We can go outside. I am outside. I'm going to meet you outside.
Yeah.
So it's essentially three characters. Well, it's not essentially. It is three characters in this scene because we're talking about trios, right? And the three characters are Mephistopheles, which is the devil in human form, Dr. Faust, who is the main character, and Valentin, who is the brother of Marguerite, who is Faust's, basically the quintessential perfect woman for Faust. And Well, there's a couple of reasons why I chose this one. One, it's all male voices, which I always think is kind of interesting and fun to listen to. So we have Mephistopheles, which is usually a bass, maybe a bass baritone, but like it's pretty low and it's just a killer role. So you got to have quite a bit of range. Valentin, which is a traditional baritone role, it's, you know, so he has, you know, it's definitely not tenor, but like it sits a bit higher. And then you have Faust, which is a lyric tenor role in the French repertoire. And basically what happens is Faust is trying to serenade Marguerite from outside her house without knowing that her brother has come back from war and he is not a happy camper. So he comes out and basically is like, what do you want? You want a duel? We'll duel. And that's what happens. And what's happening in the trio is basically Valentin is saying, I'm going to fight to save my sister's honor. Faust is basically saying, oh God, I really don't want to have to murder this guy. And Mephistopheles is like, oh, we're totally going to murder this guy. don't worry about it. It's going to be fine. But, it's the music of it is pretty awesome. And what's interesting about this, as opposed to The Marriage of Figaro, is basically all three of those independent thoughts are happening at the same time. and they're kind of singing over each other, but it still meshes well. And again, that's a credit to the composer. And of course, like, there's a couple of moments where you just get like this soaring tenor line, and it's pretty amazing. So I hope that was, did it justice and sort of set the scene for folks who haven't listened to this. And we'll do our obligatory, we'll put some links in the show notes to let people find these pretty easily, because they're not easy to find if you don't know where to look. But Dan, this one, what do you think of this?
Yeah, so this one was interesting because when I was listening to these, I listened to the Mozart first, and then I listened to this one. And similar to the Mozart, you have the overlapping voice parts, and each character is expressing their feelings and kind of reinforcing their part in the narrative at the same time. And it's, I think this is one that you could definitely grow to love more and more with each subsequent listening, because mm-hmm. like you said, all three characters are singing at the same time, and it's so dense with content and with music that you could notice new details each time
Absolutely.
You listen to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And in this case, the interplay of the voices is ramping up the intensity, because ultimately we're going to end up with a duel to the death.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of using the same musical devices to achieve a different end mm-hmm. than the Mozart. And it just does such a great job of dialing up the suspense. And I think it's also a pretty cool piece because each one of the characters does get a moment to shine.
Yes.
Like they're all participating together with the overlapping vocal lines, which is that technically a fugue? Is that a fugue? Or is it not a fugue?
It's not quite, because I think there's enough variation that you, like, a fugue is like a literal repetition of a theme. Ah. And this is, there's definitely like some borrowing, and there's definitely some, overlapping motifs in it, but it's not like resuscitation of the same thing.
Gotcha. Well, I was wondering about that, so thank you for answering that question. But I think it's a great piece. As a performer, it seems like something that would be really fun to do, because you get to do that, complex interplay with your scene partners, but then you also get your own moment to shine, no matter which of the three parts you're playing.
Yeah, and what you just made me think of with that comment is that one of the reasons why I think this is very interesting is because there's so much voice crossing, right? So mm-hmm. typically you would, in traditional choir music or hymns and things like that, four-part harmony, people stay in order. So the soprano is at the top, the mezzo is in the middle, tenor is under that, and then the bass is on the bottom. There's all sorts of crossing, right? So there are moments when Valentin is the highest voice in the entire thing. And I think there might be one or two where Mephistopheles kind of shouts out something, and he's actually one of the higher voices. So that to me is always kind of interesting when that sort of thing happens, because it's a little bit of a weird thing for the singer, because you're like, wait a minute, where's that note? What is going on? But, there's a lot of interplay, even though it's not like fully in unison, which I always think is kind of fun. Let's get to our final one, which was Richard Strauss's 1911 opera Der Rosenkavalier. And in full disclosure, This one took me a long time to wrap my head around, this opera generally. And when I say a long time, I'm not kidding. It probably took me like 20 years of like listening to it to like try to figure it out, because it is super complicated. And I was like, ugh, Rose. And it's probably, you know, in my impetuous youth, I was like, the tenor role is like dog shit because he's on the thing. I mean, like it's great because like you literally like he's on stage for like 5 minutes and he probably makes, you know, pretty penny because it's not an easy part to sing. But like that's it of a 4.5 hour opera, right? Like it's super long. Strauss is kind of the, I don't know, the evolution of Wagner, so it's super dense. There's a lot of orchestra. I guess my 10-second synopsis of this opera is, it sucks to get old, but sometimes you just gotta let go. And yeah. And I guess once I got old, I was like, oh, I totally get it now. So this is the final trio. It essentially ends the opera, and it's between three women this time. And it is the Marchalene, which is the main soprano role. It is Octavian, which is her male suitor, which is typically played by a mezzo soprano. And it is Sophie, who is a younger woman who was, in the beginning of the opera, she is sort of promised to one person, but in the end, she ends up with Octavian, and these two young people get to get together and have a wonderful life together. It is one of the most sublime pieces of music in opera, and if you have never heard it, I encourage you to listen to it, and listen to it probably 3 or 4 times in a row and like wrap your head around it. Cause like you probably won't get it the first time, and that's okay. Like, you know, with all my education and whatever that's worth, like it took me a while to get it, but when you get it, and it's pretty freaking amazing. So, what do you think of this one?
Well, I gotta tell you, like, I don't care what this is about. I don't care what's happening in the scene. You know, they could be singing a grocery list. Like, mm-hmm. I don't care because the music is that beautiful. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I can't explain why. I typically enjoy the way that female voices interact with each other in duets mm-hmm. and trios. Mm-hmm. Can't explain it. But this was awesome. And it was definitely in contrast to the other pieces that we listened to, where the characters kind of have this more like frantic or energetic mm-hmm. thing happening between each other. Lots of, you know, lots of notes, lots of things to say. And each, you know, sort of, each character having their own agenda. Mm-hmm. And in this piece, it was much different. So in the other pieces, you have, you know, these overlapping voices, and the way that the music is written is more symbolic of conflict. Mm-hmm. This piece has much more like legato vocal lines. Mm-hmm. And the way that the voices interact with each other felt like ocean waves lapping up on the shore or something mm-hmm. like that. It's just gorgeous. I mean, I could listen to these three people just sing all day. There's this thing that happens when a harmony is perfect. It's like, I call it like, it's like a ping or something. Yeah, you know, something. Yeah. It's like, yeah, it just blends so well that it like locks in perfectly like a puzzle piece or something like that. It's difficult to explain, but it's just, this is breathtaking, honestly. I mean, I had chills listening to this, and I don't mean that in like a symbolic way. Like, I literally had chills listening to it because it was so good. I don't mean to gush, but I just loved it.
Yeah, I mean, it's well regarded in the opera community as just being one of the most gorgeous things in the operatic canon. And what you said it very well, because you're like, there's not conflict, it just kind of like comes together, and that's really, it's really telling the story of people coming like to peace with a decision and accepting sort of how things are happening in the world around them. And what's really, so not to get too deep into the details, but essentially the Marchalan, who is older, is having this tryst with this younger person, Octavian, but then she sees that he is falling in love with this person who is his peer, Sophie, and she realizes that like her time with him needs to come to an end, because this is ultimately what's going to make him happy. And she comes to peace with that decision, and this scene is sort of culminating that decision and sort of walking away from that situation. And what's excruciatingly beautiful about it is that this trio, and then into sort of the end of the opera, which follows, quotes musical motifs from the very beginning, when she's so hopeful and so much in love with her life and with this person. And it's a weird thing, but it happens certainly plenty of times in opera. And you know, it, in a weird way, I connect this to like the soundtrack of your life, right? Like where you listen to one thing when you're 15 and then you come back to it when you're 45 and it means something totally different, and you're like, oh my gosh, I remember when I first heard this. And it like evokes all those sort of like mental memories that comes with it. And I think that there's definitely an element to this piece in feeling that nostalgia, and I think that's why it endures. I mean, it's over 100 years old and people still go to see it. And it's the rest of the opera, the middle of the opera is kind of all over the place. I mean, it's like 4.5 hours. So, and you like wait because you're like, well, the last half hour is fucking amazing, so I don't really care.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. I mean, this one might be have to be a field trip for us. Like, we might just have to go and see it because it's playing this year. And I've seen it, but it's like one of those things where it's like, all right, I'm gonna get mentally prepared for this. I'm gonna like get psyched up, and then I'm just gonna like enjoy it while I'm there.
Yeah, I'm down for that. I don't listen to opera nearly as frequently as you do. But I've been to the opera a couple of times and I do enjoy it, and I'd totally be down for seeing this. Yeah, it's a great piece. And then like after the princess leaves the stage and then the two younger lovers are left on the stage, like then they have like an incredible,
yeah, it's not long, but it's together. An incredible moment.
It's not long. Yeah, yeah. Oh my God, the harmonies to that. I was just like, I'm listening to that. You know, I got it on YouTube in my living room, and I'm just like, oh, it's so good. Oh. And it's like, and I was like, you know, we're recording on a Saturday evening, and I'm like, I'm gonna have like my nice coffee and use like the milk steaming contraption, you know, the milk frothing contraption, and make a beautiful cup of coffee, and then just sit there and listen to this for 13 minutes on Sunday morning.
Yeah, it's not a bad way to start your day, man. It'll make you appreciate everything. So that was my list. I hope it was fun for you, Dan. I hope it was fun for our listeners. And I thought, you know, that's like, again, just another way to make things a little bit more accessible, because I'll pick out the highlights, because, you know, certain times when you're listening to opera, like, there'll just be a moment that happens and it'll just smack you in the face. And if you don't know it's coming, you're like, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah.
But like, yeah, sometimes when you know they're coming, you're like, oh, it's going to be so awesome when we get there.
Right. So, right. And, you know, and I think that opera, you know, for a lot of people is just so, it's just so different from what they normally hear. And it's something that you have to, it's something that, like, these days you have to seek it out, mm-hmm, in order, mm-hmm, to listen to it. And I think it is helpful to, like, you know, dip your toe in the water and, like, think about what you just heard and that kind of stuff, because the worst way to introduce something to someone who's just, like, not used to it or not quite on board is to make them, you know, go to the opera and sit there for 3.5 hours, you know.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I'll say this. Not every opera is for everybody, but there's at least one opera for everybody. And, like, we just listen to music that's expanded basically 150 years. So it's like, right, you can find, I would hope you would be able to say, like, oh, this one is for me and this one is not. Right. And then go from there.
Yeah. And I think that people just have, I mean, and I kind of include myself in this, is like, people have very little as far as, like, a basis of knowledge, mm-hmm, for opera. And really, it's just as diverse a sub-genre of music as
anything. Other. Country, like, yeah, you know, rock, hip-hop, whatever. Like, there's definitely, you know, offshoots of all those things. And some are for, you know, some folks, and some are for others, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I certainly agree with that. And I don't know, even though I don't listen to it much, I find the genre of opera interesting, because I think that there are, I'm being pretty general here, but there are three genres of music that have, like, very niche audiences with very enthusiastic, mm-hmm, fan bases, that are maybe a little bit like edgelordy, gatekeeper, like,
sure, sure, sure.
And that's opera, metal, and jazz.
Yeah.
And, you know, in some ways that's good, in some ways that's bad, but, you know, I say give it a shot, because there's a reason that there's people who are enthusiastic about this stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So thanks for going on this journey with me and walking down this path. I appreciate it. It's your choice for our next episode. So what do we got ready for our listeners?
So we're going to do something that's, you know, just a little bit more obscure for, at least for most people. We are going to be talking about the album Too Bright by the artist who goes by the moniker Perfume Genius. So it's going to be a little poppy, but also a little bit experimental. And for some reason, Joe, I think you're going to like it.
All right.
But you never know.
Well, I have no idea what you're talking about. So it's going to be new, if nothing else.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's what's coming up for the next one. And as always, we appreciate anyone who spends their time with us going on these discussions. And we will see you next time. Brothers in Song is written and produced by Joseph Collin and Daniel Collin, and edited by Daniel Collin. To keep up with the latest news, follow us on Instagram at Brothers in Song. Until next time, listen to some new music. You just may surprise yourself.